Suddenly, she threw the cigarette and the burning match on the carpet.
"Oh, you want too much," she cried to Gatsby. "I love you now. Isn't that enough? I can't help what's past."
She began to sob helplessly.
"I did love him once, but I loved you too."
Gatsby's eyes opened and closed.
"You loved me too," he repeated.
"Even that's a lie," said Tom savagely. "She didn't know you were alive. Why, there are things between Daisy and me that you'll never know, things that neither of us can ever forget."
The words seemed to bite physically into Gatsby.
"I want to speak to Daisy alone," he insisted. "She's all excited now."
"Even alone, I can't say I never loved Tom," she admitted in a pitiful voice. "It wouldn't be true."
"Of course it wouldn't," agreed Tom.
She turned to her husband.
"As if it mattered to you," she said.
"Of course it matters. I'm going to take better care of you from now on."
"You don't understand," said Gatsby, with a touch of panic. "You're not going to take care of her any more."
"I'm not?" Tom opened his eyes wide and laughed. He could afford to control himself now. "Why's that?"
"Daisy's leaving you."
"Nonsense."
"I am, though," she said, with a visible effort.
"She's not leaving me," Tom's words suddenly leaned down over Gatsby. "Certainly not for a common swindler who'd have to steal the ring he put on her finger."
"I won't stand this," cried Daisy. "Oh, please, let's get out."
"Who are you, anyhow?" broke out Tom.
"You are one of that bunch that hangs around with Maya Wolfsheim. That much I happen to know. I've made a little investigation into your affairs, and I'll carry it further tomorrow."
"You can suit yourself about that, old sport," said Gatsby steadily.
"I found out what your drug stores were." He turned to us and spoke rapidly. "He and this Wolfsheim bought up a lot of side street drug stores here and in Chicago and sold grain alcohol over the counter. That's one of his little stunts. I picked him for a bootlegger the first time I saw him, and I wasn't far wrong."
"What about it?" said Gatsby politely. "I guess your friend Walter Chase wasn't too proud to come in on it."
"And you left him in the lurch, didn't you? You let him go to jail for a month over in New Jersey. God, you ought to hear Walter on the subject of you."
"He came to us dead broke. He was very glad to pick up some money, old sport."
"Don't you call me old sport," cried Tom.
Gatsby said nothing.
"Walter could have you up on the betting laws, too, but Wolfsheim scared him into shutting his mouth."
That unfamiliar yet recognizable look was back again in Gatsby's face.
"That drugstore business was just small change," continued Tom slowly. "But you've got something on now that Walter's afraid to tell me about."
I glanced at Daisy, who was staring terrified between Gatsby and her husband, and at Jordan, who had begun to balance an invisible but absorbing object on the tip of her chin. Then I turned back to Gatsby, and was startled at his expression. He looked, and this is said in all contempt for the babbled slander of his garden, as if he had killed a man. For a moment, the set of his face could be described in just that fantastic way. It passed, and he began to talk excitedly to Daisy, denying everything, defending his name against accusations that had not been made. But with every word she was drawing further and further into herself, so he gave that up, and only the dead dream fought on as the afternoon slipped away, trying to touch what was no longer tangible, struggling unhappily and despairingly toward that lost voice across the room. The voice begged again to go.
"Please, Tom, I can't stand this any more."
Her frightened eyes told that whatever intentions, whatever courage she had had, were definitely gone.
"You too start on home, Daisy," said Tom, "in Mr. Gatsby's car."
She looked at Tom, alarmed now, but he insisted with magnanimous scorn.
"Go on, he won't annoy you. I think he realizes that his presumptuous little flirtation is over."
They were gone, without a word, snapped out, made accidental, isolated, like ghosts even from our pity. After a moment, Tom got up and began wrapping the unopened bottle of whiskey in the towel.
"Want any of this stuff? Jordan? Nick?"
I didn't answer.
"Nick?" he asked again.
"What?
Want any?"
"No. I just remembered that today's my birthday."
I was 30. Before me stretched the portentous menacing road of a new decade.
It was 7 o'clock when we got into the coupe with him and started for Long Island. Tom talked incessantly, exulting and laughing, but his voice was as remote from Jordan and me as the foreign clamour on the sidewalk or the tumult of the elevated overhead. Human sympathy has its limits, and we were content to let all their tragic arguments fade with the city lights behind. 30. The promise of a decade of loneliness, a thinning list of single men to know, a thinning briefcase of enthusiasm, thinning hair. But there was Jordan beside me, who, unlike Daisy, was too wise ever to carry well-forgotten dreams from age to age. As we passed over the dark bridge, her wan face fell lazily against my coat's shoulder, and the formidable stroke of 30 died away with the reassuring pressure of her hand. So we drove on toward death through the cooling twilight. The young Greek, Michaelis, who ran the coffee joint beside the ash heaps, was the principal witness at the inquest. He had slept through the heat until after 5, when he strolled over to the garage and found George Wilson sick in his office, really sick, pale as his own pale hair and shaking all over. Michaelis advised him to go to bed, but Wilson refused, saying that he'd miss a lot of business if he did. While his neighbor was trying to persuade him, a violent racket broke out overhead. "I've got my wife locked in up there," explained Wilson calmly. "She's going to stay there till the day after tomorrow, and then we're going to move away." Michaelis was astonished. They had been neighbors for 4 years, and Wilson had never seemed faintly capable of such a statement. Generally, he was one of these worn-out men. When he wasn't working, he sat on a chair in the doorway and stared at the people and the cars that passed along the road. When anyone spoke to him, he invariably laughed in an agreeable, colourless way. He was his wife's man and not his own. So, naturally, Michaelis tried to find out what had happened, but Wilson wouldn't say a word. Instead, he began to throw curious, suspicious glances at his visitor and ask him what he'd been doing at certain times on certain days. Just as the latter was getting uneasy, some workmen came past the door bound for his restaurant, and Michaelis took the opportunity to get away, intending to come back later. But he didn't. He supposed he forgot to. That's all. When he came outside again a little after 7, he was reminded of the conversation because he heard Mrs. Wilson's voice, loud and scolding, downstairs in the garage. "Beat me!" he heard her cry. "Throw me down and beat me, you dirty little coward!" A moment later, she rushed out into the dusk, waving her hands and shouting. Before he could move from his door, the business was over. The death car, as the newspapers called it, didn't stop. It came out of the gathering darkness, wavered tragically for a moment, and then disappeared around the next bend. Michaelis wasn't even sure of its color. He told the first policeman that it was light green. The other car, the one going toward New York, came to rest 100 yards beyond, and its driver hurried back to where Myrtle Wilson, her life violently extinguished, knelt in the road and mingled her thick, dark blood with the dust. Michaelis and this man reached her first, but when they had torn open her shirtwaist, still damp with perspiration, they saw that her left breast was swinging loose like a flap, and there was no need to listen for the heart beneath. The mouth was wide open and ripped at the corners, as though she had choked a little in giving up the tremendous vitality she had stored so long.